Time for Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt here with us, and we're joined on the telephone by the author of a very, very interesting book entitled We Average Unbeautiful Watchers, Fan Narratives and the Reading of American Sports. Noah Cohan with us. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich. It's great to be with you.
Man, it really is a fantastic book, and I was taken by something right in the introduction that sets the tone for this. Being a sports fan is an autobiographical practice. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. It's a common trope for sports fans to be asked, you know, how did you become a sports fan? And usually it's some story of I connected with my dad, or, I moved to a new town and I connected with the local team. We all have a story of how we became a sports fan. And that is an autobiographical practice. We're telling a story, an autobiographical story, about who we are, in a sense, and that who we are, it determines a lot more than just the particular team, right? It says something about ourselves, whether it's a region or a particular university or a connection to a particular sport, especially if that sport is not one of the big main ones like football or basketball. Like if you have a connection to, I don't know, Johns Hopkins lacrosse, right? There's a story there that says something about your biography. So yeah, I think automatically being a sports fan and telling people about the teams you care about or individual athletes you care about is an autobiographical practice.
Yeah, this is Bruce. One of the things I thought about as I was driving up today and after reading the book is how those connections are different in the sense that your Johns Hopkins lacrosse affinity might be because you played there, you had a child played there. But we develop these relationships with professional sports teams where people start to refer to them as we. You know, when the Patriots mm-hmm. lose a game, we could have played better. Do you think mm-hmm. that there's a real change in the individual identity of sports fans around that concept?
I do think it is changing somewhat, especially in online discourse and especially regarding sports like basketball, the NBA in particular, that really market and emphasize the sort of individual personalities of the athletes as characters, if you will, such that they're not just having you follow the logo of the team, but they want you to invest in who LeBron is, right? Or, who Kawhi Leonard is. And so that I think has opened up a lot of sports fans' thinking to investment beyond just we or us on a team-based level.
When you write about baseball, it's a fascinating dichotomy, a sport that people often talk about for its pastoral qualities and attributes, but also coming from a game that has a long history of gambling and in the news again this week, cheating as well.
Yeah, baseball is an interesting sport because the mythography of it is all green grass and sort of pastoral Americana. But it's really an urban sport, always has been, you know, grew out of New York City. And has always been, you know, one of the earliest sports to be measured and metricized via statistics. The box score came early on. And also one, as you pointed out, that's always been associated with some sort of seedy underbelly of society, whether that's, you know, gamblers betting on games or, as you mentioned, the current scandals in Major League Baseball. So it's interesting how the mythos of baseball doesn't really match what we actually know about its history.
One of the things that you do so remarkably in the book is go across all kinds of media. And I thought Travis Vogan, who's been on the show a number of times, said it well. What led you to sort of take this as this big a scopey kind of idea and sort of looking down on top of everything?
Yeah, well, I was coming up in an English PhD program. So, you know, looking at literary texts was kind of what I was there to do. But I quickly realized that sort of my idea about what sports were, these narratives that we all love to interpret, was applicable far beyond just conventional literary work. So when I started on the book, I really thought, okay, I'm gonna try and show that by doing it across genres, as you mentioned. So I start with the novel, but I go through films and I go through blog posts and I show that in all these forums, we're telling stories about sports that show us how sports are themselves stories that we crave to read and talk about.
And I thought it was fascinating the way you weaved in Don DeLillo's Underworld.
Yeah, it's a great text. A fantastic example of a kind of historical fiction that, you know, provides you with historical characters who you know, like Russ Hodges, Jackie Robinson, Ralph Branca, but also inserts fictional characters that get you to think more deeply about how we understand those historical events, how we have this idea that this historical thing happened and there's a set narrative of what really happened. But actually, there's so much more texture there. There's so many more details that we could maybe know about if we had been there or if we if we knew a narrative about them. So I think DeLillo, by writing fiction about a historical event, really opens up those possibilities for us.
I teach hockey lit at University of Maine, and we have a lot of novels in that class. And one of the things that I've noticed is the difference in the way athletes react to those novels and non-athletes react to them. The athletes know their fiction, but sometimes the non-athletes read them almost as if they're creative nonfiction or autobiography. If you got, I can't figure out why. Have you got any idea?
I think athletes oftentimes understand that there's a difference between what the spectators understand of their performance and their feeling of it, right? That they understand that to a certain extent they are performing a character for everyone there, even though they're giving their full effort, they're trying, you know, it's a competition, they are trying to win, it is not predetermined, but that the athletic persona that they demonstrate for us on the court or on the field is not synonymous with them as a human being. And I think fans too often collapse that distinction. They think that the athletic performance and the human being are one and the same. But I think if we think of that more as a performance, as athletes often do, we can understand more about how complicated and textured sporting events really are.
We're talking with Noah Cohan about his book, We Average Unbeautiful Watchers. I was really struck by the notion that fandom can easily cross that line into obsession and how it also can be economically emasculating.
Yeah, that's one of the things I explore in my chapter on film. There is a sort of stereotype out there about a certain kind of like nerdy, super obsessed sports fan who sort of is a loser, if you will. And the best example of this might be Patton Oswalt's film Big Fan, where he plays a New York Giants fan. And he, you know, he works in a parking garage. And the opening scene is this guy in a Beamer or some other luxury car comes in and snaps at him a little bit. And finally, he gives the guy the ticket. And the guy says, "Have fun in your box." You're like, "You loser," right? And so the film proceeds from there to show this idea that sports fandom is somehow limiting his ambition with regard to his career and other aspects of his life. But ultimately, the sort of ending subverts that a little bit, I think. But yeah, it's definitely a line of discourse in stereotypes of sports fans. Even though, you know, in a lot of cases we think of sports fandom as like hyper masculine, there's also this idea of the obsessive nerdy sports fan as a kind of a loser.
As a kid, I remember going to Yankee Stadium, to old-timers games in the late 50s, games in the early 60s, and I don't remember people wearing jerseys. You'd see a guy with a hat here and there, but people didn't seem to dress up for games the way they do now. I think that's part of what leads us into the obsession, is that you can walk down the street, now everybody knows where you stand.
Sure, and you know, the leagues have figured out that consumerism is great for business, and selling as many jerseys as they can is something they want to do. And fans, now that that's available, they can sell fashion. You know, they can buy those jerseys, but they can also do creative things with jerseys and other attire. You see now the fans who come to the games with the faces painted and the giant get-ups, in the same way that you see comic book fans go to Comic-Con dressed as their favorite character. So there's a similar level of means by which fans who are deeply invested in a particular team or a particular athlete on that team want to physically transform themselves to show that deep investment. And yeah, that's definitely a change from earlier eras of sports fandom and comic book fandom for that matter.
And we also see, I think, in the extremes of that, this notion that some fans have that they are a part of the game, whether it's the Cameron crazies down at Duke or those fans with face paint on, those people of the 12th man, the people who believe that through our efforts, we are actually a part of this enterprise.
Absolutely. I think that's really actually pretty common. A lot of fans feel that way. And the real problem comes in when they feel like the athletes owe them something. You know, we saw this when LeBron made the decision and left, and fans were burning his jersey and recording these really ugly diatribes on YouTube and other platforms, right? They felt like LeBron owed them something. But LeBron was making a business decision for him and his family, right? But the real sense was they had invested their time and energy in supporting him when he was a member of the Cavaliers, so it was a real betrayal if he were to make that decision. So I think one thing that I emphasize in the book as a kind of prescription or recommendation for sports fans is that we examine our actual connection to these athletes and understand that as human beings, they don't actually owe us anything. They make business decisions, and we can choose to separate from them in terms of our connection to them. But that we shouldn't be embittered on the level that many fans are when an athlete, you know, chooses to leave a particular team.
And I feel like part of that is because so many fans play the sport, perhaps not well themselves, and don't think of this as a job, as many of the players do, and say, boy, if I had that opportunity, well, the first thing I would do is I would play as hard as I could every single day. I would never take it easy. I would never jog down the base path. And by gosh, if I had a chance to give my team a hometown discount, I would do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's fans' connection to sport is in their leisure time. So they think of it as always fun, right? But when something becomes your job, when you are doing it all the time, every day, practicing, putting in the training hours that athletes put in, doing the media obligations, putting in all these things, it is not leisure time anymore. It is not play. It is serious business. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of athletes actually aren't that big of fans of the particular sports they play. And this drives fans crazy. They expect that athletes should be the biggest fans of the sports they play. But Some athletes are just exceptionally talented athletes, good at that particular sport, but they don't actually care that much about the game itself beyond their professional obligation. So I think that's another thing that we fans might better consider, is that a job is a job, and we shouldn't expect that athletes be required to love it the same way we do.
When I was young, my sports heroes were people I rarely saw, even on television. You might see them playing in a game, or you might see them at an advertisement, but you didn't see them all the time the way people see them now. And I'm wondering how much of these identities that people create for their heroes or the athletes they most like really is from some visual cue as opposed to really, really knowledge about them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency to take the on-court narratives or the on-court stories that we get from just watching the games themselves and crave more than that. And our online culture especially encourages and provides that. You know, the athletes write things on their Twitter feed or show pictures on their Instagram, and we feel like we have access to different parts of their lives. And this leads to a kind of daydreaming about what that person might be like and how we might be connected to them. And, you know, it can deepen a lot of fandoms. At the same time, you know, those social media postings are no more necessarily authentic than the athletic performance itself is. So I think it's okay to enjoy the characters, the athletes as characters, both in competitive display and in these other forums. But to know that, you know, if that athlete suddenly doesn't fulfill your expectations for that character, that their choice as a real human is different than the choice you would have liked them to make, that, you know, you've got to sort of take your lumps and either move on or just accept that athlete has changed or made a different decision.
It's very interesting, too, the discussion you have in the book about the role women play when it comes to the popular culture depiction of athletics.
Yeah, women are an increasing force in fandom, just in terms of sheer consumer numbers, if nothing else, but also in, you know, getting their voices out there in sports media and in online forums, you know, on social media about sports and on podcasts and other things. And, women have been playing sports as long as there have been sports, but for a long time their voices couldn't really be heard or their participation was obscured in a lot of ways. But in our culture today, they have an increasingly large role. And I think that offers the larger culture a lot of opportunities because we have associated with sports a lot of traditional ideas about what masculinity is, maybe even hyper-masculinity in relationship to stoicism, in relationship to particular forms of acceptable violence. And a lot of women who are invested in sports question those traditional things. And I think ultimately for the better. They can make male sports fans re-examine why those things are so strongly associated with sports and how sports might be different if we de-emphasize them a little bit.
You talk about the role of Bill Simmons in the fan-authored sports blog and his role in the creation of that. And I wanted to ask you about another phase of that we've seen. We see it locally, we see it regionally, certainly here with the Boston sports media. And that's what I call, and not out of respect, I call fanboy radio, with the sports radio hosts who are just unabashed homers for that local team.
Yeah, I mean, I think as much as I would encourage and like to see a sort of more contemplative version of sports fandom out there, there's still a lot of money to be made in appealing to the sort of baser instincts of a particular kind of male sports fan, right? The continued existence of Barstool Sports, I think, is evidence of that as well.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we should throw up our arms and give up, because I think, you know, these changes are made inch by inch culturally. And I think if people with more progressive social views give up on the field of sports entirely, then we'll really have lost something special. Because I really do think in their purest essence, sports are not determined by that, that they can be empowering for people of all genders, races, sexual orientations, right? There are problems with a Jackie Robinson-style narrative of sports as the great equalizer, right? But the core truth of the level playing field and the core truth of the possibility of sports to help people express where they're coming from and larger problems in society, I think is really still always there. So, I think just because the fanboys are out there bringing down the discourse a little bit doesn't mean we should give up on sports as a platform.
Are you optimistic that we're going to see better days, or not sure?
I don't know. You know, there's a lot to be determined in our larger culture in the next year, decades, certainly. So who knows? But I'm a lifelong sports fan, and I don't think I could ever give it up completely. But I want to love it with a critical eye. I want to be able to criticize it and say, hey, we can do better here, and hope that other sports fans are with me in working to make those changes.
Well, I hope that Scott Peterson's convinced you to become part of the Sport Literature Association, and we'll see you in June in St. Louis.
You certainly will. I live here in St. Louis, so I will be in attendance.
Excellent. I'm the program chair. Send me something.
All right.
Noah, thank you so much. The book is a fascinating read, and we really appreciate you making time to talk with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Rich and Bruce. Really appreciate it.
The book is called We Average Unbeautiful Watchers: Fan Narratives and the Reading of American Sports by Noah Cohan, C-O-H-A-N. And interesting read, and thought-provoking is one. I thought of a post I saw earlier today on Twitter from Alex Reimer, who's been working in sports media. And maybe this is a sign when you talk about that different viewpoint on sports. He tweeted earlier today, "I've always known two things about myself. I'm gay and love to write about sports. I'm super excited to combine the two as the new deputy managing editor of OutSports. There are lots of great stories of courage to tell."
Yep. I only know about OutSports from Harrison Brown.
Step in the right direction.
Step in the right direction.
That was great.
Yeah, he's really good, isn't he?
And we love the Skype, too.
Yeah, Skype is so great. Scott Peterson told me, he says, you got to talk to this guy. And I said, yeah, okay, we'll do that. We like the book. We'll do that.
Awesome.